Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 28th of January. Our main stories: on the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, survivors warn not to forget the horrors of the Nazis. The mayor of Wuhan has blamed Chinese government bureaucracy for the delay in warning the public about the coronavirus outbreak. And US prosecutors have asked the son of Queen Elizabeth, Prince Andrew, to be interviewed, but have had no response. Also in the podcast:
no opioids, no muscle relaxant, very light anesthesia, and therefore the patient, after the operation, was able to do almost everything without big problems.
We speak to the doctor who's revolutionised lung surgery, and the campaign in Western Australia to have shipping rerouted to protect whale sharks from injury. Survivors of the Holocaust have made impassioned pleas to fight a rise in anti-Semitism. They were speaking at Auschwitz, 75 years after it was liberated by Soviet troops. Auschwitz-Birkenau was the biggest of the Nazi death camps. About 1.1 million people were murdered there as part of Hitler's plan to exterminate all of Europe's Jews, his so-called final solution. Most were murdered in gas chambers as soon as they arrived. Other victims included Romani people, homosexuals and political prisoners. From Poland, our correspondent Kevin Connolly sent this report.
Scoured by the hard-edged winter winds of southern Poland, Auschwitz looked today much as it must have looked to the Soviet soldiers who chanced upon it all those years ago. The familiar high brick arch, through which ran the trains that carried nearly a million of the Jews of Europe to their deaths, has been carefully preserved. Protected by a cathedral-sized tent built around it, kings and presidents, heads of state and government, gathered in its shade. But today, they were not the VIPs. That honour went to the 200 survivors, still strong enough to come. They told stories of starvation and torture, of sounds of screaming coming from gas chambers, of prisoners burned alive. There were moments when the weight of memory was almost too much. Elza Baker was the second survivor to speak, following Bathsheba Dagan, who had asked why the world had not come to the prisoners' aid. Elza Baker had suffered too, but with kindness and with humility, seemed more concerned with the suffering of others.
It is an honour for me to be here among so many people who have suffered so greatly, perhaps even much more so than I. And I'm upset. You probably can feel that I'm very upset about listening to that lady there.
The lesson of the day was simple. The Holocaust must be remembered if it is not one day to be repeated. Another survivor, the Polish historian Marian Turski, addressed that lesson to the young people of the world, for whom Auschwitz may now seem remote.
Nie bądźcie obojętni, kiedy jakakolwiek mniejszość.
Do not be indifferent when any minority is discriminated against, because the essence of democracy is that the majority governs, but democracy hinges on the rights of minorities being protected, and they have to be protected.
At one point in the service, the Hadesh, the Jewish prayer for the dead, echoed around this camp built to kill the Jews of Europe. But in this place of horror today, the living could still gather to remember the dead. We can't know how many survivors will still be alive the next time the world gathers to remember Auschwitz. So today was an important chance to listen. Maybe the words nor the music will ever quite feel like enough. But of course, they are all we have.
That report from Auschwitz by Kevin Connolly. As the number of coronavirus infections in China continues to rise, the blame game has started. The mayor of Wuhan, the city at the heart of the epidemic, said that bureaucratic rules within the central communist authorities had slowed the initial response. Zhou Xian Wang said he needed authorization before he could alert the public.
Facing a sudden virus outbreak, our continuous work wasn't performed well enough. I feel that our capability of dealing with a crisis needs to be improved.
At the same time, a health official in the capital has pointed the finger at local authorities in rural areas, who he accused of lacking determination in controlling the epidemic. More than 80 people have now died, including the first person in Beijing. There are nearly 3,000 confirmed cases, with 460 people critically ill. Wuhan itself is in virtual lockdown. A student living in the city who doesn't want to be named says everyone there is scared.
Generally, the streets are empty. There is fear and panic. Initially, we were calm, but we realized that the infections keep rising. And they've told us not to even go to hospital if you are sick, because you're safer when you are home. So this is also now making us panic more.
Other cities are also suspending public transport and stopping private cars entering or leaving. So how are people coping with these restrictions? I spoke to Kerry Allen at the BBC Monitoring Desk as she looked at reaction online.
A lot of people are talking today about the fact that schools and exams are postponed. So this is obviously not only going to affect children, but also parents. If they want to go back to work, now they've got to stay in and look after their children. And I've even had friends reaching out and saying, could you send some face masks and in here? I don't know why, but mouth ulcer treatments as well. I assume...
So these are supplies that they want you to get to send out to them in China?
Yes, because there is a big problem at the moment, particularly with face masks and antiseptic creams, that they're in such high demand throughout the country because people are worried that they can't get them on major platforms like Taobao or JD.com.
And what about food and things like that?
One of the things we have seen in Wuhan, one of the cities that's in lockdown, there has been a social media video about a supermarket where the price of produce has dropped down to 1 yuan. So that's very cheap. That's about 15 US cents.
So that's being subsidised?
Yes, it is, yeah. There's the concern from some people that they don't want to go out full stop, so they're buying online. One of the things I have seen, there's a little video, this is in Hangzhou, of a robot that's sending food to isolated people, and it almost looks like a vacuum cleaner, and it's got dishes stacked up, and it goes along the corridors to various people's rooms and delivers food directly to them.
Extraordinary, but that's obviously only a solution for a very small number of people. How are people following how the epidemic is spreading?
Online, the government's trying to give as much transparency as possible. I mean, People's Daily and CCTV, the official channels, have been daily updating a graph, a map that shows how far people are affected. So, I mean, this is today's map. It says that more than 2,700 people have got the coronavirus.
And that's these provinces, different colours, showing how many people in each province have the virus. There's only one which is white.
Yes, that's Tibet.
So they have none in Tibet, but everywhere else has some cases at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's about 6 different regions that have over 100 confirmed cases. And these are right in the centre. So towards the west, there are few cases, but in the middle of China and surrounding, it's very widespread.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. Doctors in England have become the first in the world to remove a cancer patient's lung using keyhole surgery. Until now, the operation involved making a wide cut through the chest wall, a painful and complex procedure. In this case, 74-year-old Raymond Page, who was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer last summer, was out of bed and talking just hours after the operation. The surgeon, Giuseppe Arasu, told Tim Franks how it was done.
While using this technique and approaching the patient in a multidisciplinary way, we are able to decrease the impact of the operation, decrease the impact of the nerve. Therefore, we can reduce the pain and speed up the recovery. And on top of that, we can apply a very minimally invasive anesthetic technique, and therefore we can reduce to a minimum the problems that are related to opioids and other strong medication like muscle relaxant that we used during a traditional operation.
And through this 2-inch incision, you're able to retract the lung, which presumably is considerably bigger than that. And is that because the lung is quite collapsible?
Yeah, so first of all, the lung has got the consistency of a sponge. So it's like a sponge. Therefore, we put this sort of retrieval bag into the chest. We open it. We sort of fish the lung that at that point is completely detached. And then putting it into the bag, we can squeeze it and we can remove it from the small incision.
One of the things that has just been absolutely remarkable to read about this case is that clearly you were operating on an elderly man who was very sick. I mean, he had stage 4 lung cancer. And yet, within hours, he was up and able to talk, having had this major operation.
Yeah, so we decrease the surgical stress, so the patient has got a reduction of the collateral effect coming from the surgery, but in the meantime, we also decrease as much as possible the detrimental effects that are related to having a very strong general anesthesia. In his case, no opioids, no muscle relaxant, very light kind of anesthesia. And therefore, the patient, after the operation, was able to do almost everything without having big problems.
Do you know how the patient is doing at the moment?
Yeah, he's doing extremely well. He's not complaining about pain. And actually, I was very amazed about how well he's doing, because although the operation has been minimally invasive, we remove an entire lung, so there is still a big impact on his respiratory system. But despite that, he's doing amazingly well. So I'm very, very pleased to see that.
I know that surgeons are renowned for sort of having nerves of steel and ice running through their veins, but you must be just delighted by, A, the success of this operation, but it seems also that you've set a precedent here in terms of the way in which these types of operations can be conducted in the future.
We are developing this technique in order to apply it in more and more patients. And so far, we have been very, very happy about the result that we are achieving.
Giuseppe Aresu. The odds of Donald Trump being acquitted in his impeachment trial in the Senate have always been fairly high. A 2-thirds majority is needed to convict him, and Republicans have 53 of the 100 Senate seats. However, the president may be slightly less confident after the former US National Security Advisor, John Bolton, undermined his claim not to have withheld military aid to Ukraine in order to pressure that country into investigating his potential Democratic rival, Joe Biden. The president has been hoping Republicans will block Democrat attempts to call Mr. Bolton as a witness. But some Republicans may be starting to waver. One senator who could side with the Democrats is Mitt Romney.
I think it's increasingly likely that other Republicans will join those of us who think we should hear from John Bolton. And whether there are other witnesses and documents, well, that's another matter. I think it's important to be able to hear from John Bolton for us to be able to make an impartial judgment.
President Trump denies abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. So why has John Bolton entered the picture now? Anthony Zerker is our Washington correspondent.
Well, he entered the picture because he has a book coming up. The tentative publish date is the middle of March, and excerpts from that book, at least the contents of it, were reported in the New York Times yesterday. And what they said was that John Bolton, in his book, would say that there's some sort of communication he had with the president where the president said that the hold on Ukrainian money was until an investigation opened up into Donald Trump's political rivals. So essentially, John Bolton is testifying firsthand, or at least writing his book firsthand, that there was evidence of direct pressure from Trump and direct contact from Trump about the hold on Ukrainian money. That's something that we've only heard secondhand up until now, although some of the testimony that we had last year in these impeachment hearings were people who said that that was what John Bolton had told them privately. So all of a sudden now, there's a lot of interest, particularly among Democrats, to hear more about what John Bolton might have to say under oath.
Yeah, they want to hear from him firsthand. Who among the Republicans might join them?
As you mentioned, Mitt Romney is one, the senator from Utah. Susan Collins from Maine is another. They still need two more. And that's the big question. I mean, it's a simple question of math at this point. Can Democrats who will stick together on this find two more Republicans to side with them? Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is one of the names that comes up. Lamar Alexander of Tennessee is another. But if you listen to a lot of the Republicans right now, what they're talking about, they're saying, well, John Bolton may not be able to testify anyway because he was an executive official. And there's protections that the president won't have executive officials testify about candid advice they're giving them, or that the House should have called John Bolton when they were doing their investigation on the House side, and that now that it's in the Senate, it's too late. So some Republicans just say, well, nothing has changed. The question is, can Democrats find two Republicans who don't believe that?
I saw Lindsey Graham saying he might vote for the manuscript to be subpoenaed and what entered as evidence in the trial. Would that make any difference?
Well, it's certainly interesting, although I think what you'll hear from Republicans and what we've heard from Donald Trump's legal defense team is that what was in the manuscript is not part of the sworn testimony. It wasn't given under oath. And so there's an open question about the reliability of this. So even if it were brought in, there's no reason why some senators may treat it as absolute fact. It could be Donald Trump denies it, therefore we're going to dismiss this and move on the direction that it was heading, which was towards acquittal.
Anthony Zerker in Washington. The U.S. prosecutor leading the investigation into the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein has accused Queen Elizabeth's son, Prince Andrew, of failing to cooperate with requests for an interview. Epstein killed himself in jail while awaiting charges of trafficking underage girls for sex. Reporting from New York, Nick Bryant.
Answering questions from reporters outside Jeffrey Epstein's mansion close to New York's Central Park, the U.S. attorney Jeffrey Berman said that federal prosecutors, along with the FBI, had asked to interview Prince Andrew as part of their ongoing investigation into Epstein's co-conspirators. To date, though, he said that Prince Andrew had provided what he called zero cooperation. Last year, Prince Andrew announced he was stepping back from his royal duties amid renewed attention to his friendship with Epstein and in the aftermath of an interview with the BBC's Newsnight programme, which was widely deemed to have been a PR disaster. One of Epstein's accusers, Virginia Roberts, has claimed she was trafficked to Prince Andrew, an accusation he has vehemently denied. Back then, the prince said in a written statement, "Of course, I am willing to help any appropriate law enforcement agency with their investigations if required." But Mr. Berman said that although the FBI had repeatedly contacted Prince Andrew's lawyers to follow up on his previous pledge to help, none had been forthcoming.
Nick Bryant reporting. And still to come on the podcast.
I am fortunate to have a very loving family and two very supportive parents who do on a daily basis ask me when I'm going to retire because they do get worried and I have that risk factor in my mind.
As an Australian woman dies after a cake eating contest, we look at the dangers of competitive eating. In our earlier podcast, you may have heard initial reports of a plane crash in Afghanistan. It's now been confirmed that the aircraft involved was an American military communications plane. It came down in Taliban-controlled territory in Ghazni province and is thought to have been operating from the US base in Kandahar. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Marcus.
US officials acknowledge that what they describe as a small military aircraft has crashed in central Afghanistan, but they say that there is no indication that it was brought down by hostile fire. While helicopters have proven vulnerable and accident-prone in Afghanistan, the loss of a US fixed-wing aircraft is relatively rare. But the Taliban are not believed to have the sorts of anti-aircraft missiles needed to bring down a high-flying aircraft. The plane involved is an E-11A, one of only four in the whole US Air Force. Essentially, it's an adapted Bombardier executive jet, chosen for its ability to fly at high altitude and with extended range. It's packed with electronics, and its job is to enable better communications between air and ground forces and between different types of aircraft operating in difficult terrain or using incompatible data links. The aircraft, along with similar electronics mounted on unmanned systems, have played an important role in the Afghan conflict, where the mountainous landscape is a major problem for modern military communications.
Jonathan Marcus. The head of the Libyan National Oil Corporation has urged Britain, France and the US to do more to stop outside powers interfering in Libya's civil war. Mustafa Sanalla told the BBC the UN Security Council should call out the hypocrisy of foreign nations pursuing their own interests at the expense of the Libyan people. Mr. Sanalla was speaking to our diplomatic correspondent, James Landau.
Our situation is very serious. I'm afraid that Libya already become as a ground battle for other country to play the war in Libya and to play their games on the country. I'm very worried, really, Libya to become like a new Syria. This is very, very dangerous, I think. This is really threatening to us and the rest of the world, I think, the situation of the country. That's why we call always to fix the crisis in Libya and to apply the rule of law in order to avoid more terrorism in the country, to avoid more waves of migrants crossing the Mediterranean and going to Europe and to reach Europe cities. I believe this situation is, again, very serious.
The regional powers that are involved in Libya, what are they doing that are making the situation worse?
It's clear, you see, what they are doing. I think they are protecting their interests in the country. Some of them are, you know, working in Libya or playing the game in Libya to break down the NATO. Some of them, they put about the migrants in Libya, to fight the migrants in Libya. Some of them about to fight, for instance, terrorism. And so some of them both. So I think they are playing a game in Libya, not in the Libyan interest for sure, for only for their interest. What you have seen, for instance, the superpower. Again, I'm saying for superpower, especially in the Berlin talks. They are happy. We're happy. Okay, superpower were happy that they could bring more countries who have interest in Libya, who is playing Libya, I can say, and to bring together to have this statement for the ceasefire and to bring the peace, bring the justice in Libya. But actually, the want only is not enough. Unless these countries are, and to ask these countries or some individual in this country to stop their game in the country, in Libya. Because the Libya, damaging the Libya, Libya is very close to Europe, south to Europe, and gate to Africa. So I think it's a big state, and to bring the peace and justice and freedom in Libya is very important. It is not only Libyan interest, but I think it is international interest to fix the problem in Libya, to fix this crisis in Libya.
But I thought the Berlin Conference agreed that the outside powers would interfere less.
This regional power, they say something on table, they do something else on the under table. So it is not enough to say just a commitment, to say, you know, we stop playing their games in Libya. I think we need some more pressure from leverage from international, from the superpower, frankly speaking, from US, from UK, from France. So we need to listen a very clear message to this regional power to stop their games in the country.
The head of Libya's National Oil Corporation, Mustafa Sanalla, talking to James Landau. More than half the people in Australia have contributed to an appeal for funds following the devastating bushfires there, according to new research. The details from David Willis.
A survey conducted by the fundraising and marketing group More Strategic found that a staggering 53% of Australians contributed to the bushfire appeal. Roughly half of those donations went to a collection organised on behalf of a charity. A smaller but nonetheless sizeable number, some 14%, went through Facebook. As to the total, well, estimates vary. Donations are, of course, still coming in, not only from Australia but from around the world, but the fund is now thought to contain hundreds of millions of dollars after quite literally thousands of funds were set up, many of them linked to the GoFundMe website. all of which has prompted the country's Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, to pay tribute earlier today to the generosity of the Australian people. More than a week of heavy rains, of course, dampened many of the blazes in the states of Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland. The number of fires was more than halved, but the Australian Fire Service says there are still several dozen fires that are burning, and the Weather Service there in Australia is warning of another blast of hot weather later in the week. Bushfires, nothing new, of course, in Australia, but this season they started early, and 4 months in, they've already claimed the lives of more than 30 people, as well as millions of animals, including koalas, kangaroos and wallabies, many of which were burnt alive.
David Willis. Staying in Australia, or at least Australian waters, and few animals are brave enough to take on a whale shark, which can grow up to 18 metres in length. But when they come up against man, there is only going to be one winner. A five-year investigation in Australia has found that the plankton-eating giants are suffering an increasing number of injuries from shipping. Henry Bellow has been looking at the findings.
It all started because the West Australian government was so concerned about the welfare of these sharks that it introduced a new law that required every tourist boat that went out to the Ningaloo Reef, which is about halfway up the coast of West Australia, and they were going there to look at these whales, the law was that they had to take a picture of every one of them. And over 5 years, there was photos taken of about 1,000 sharks. Those photos were then passed on to researchers at the Australian Institute of Marine Science, and they found that about one-fifth of those sharks, so about 200 sharks, had some pretty serious damage to them caused by ships, and most notably from the propellers. So we're talking cuts, quite deep lacerations to their really tough skin. In some cases, that these sharks actually lost fins.
And why is this happening? After all, it is a huge ocean. Can't ships avoid whale sharks?
It is, of course, an enormous ocean, but this is a case of these sharks' migration patterns actually colliding with some of the shipping routes for major trade. So what you see here is you've got whale sharks, which are enormous animals, but they actually come up to the surface of the ocean a lot. They spend a lot of time floating at the top, often up to about an hour, and that makes them very vulnerable to colliding with these boats. But what's really concerned the researchers the most is that the period where these injuries were at their highest is actually when trade and shipping was at its highest as well, in about 2012, 2013. There's a lot of trade that comes up this coast from Perth going to Asia, and also from some of Australia's largest mines, with a lot of resources being sent to Asia.
And what about diverting shipping lanes?
That is something that the researchers want debated, but their real focus at the moment is trying to raise awareness of this problem. It is an international problem. This is happening to whale sharks, not just in Australia, but all over the world. There is precedent for shipping lanes being moved. It happened in 2013 for different reasons, to protect the reef itself. But what the researchers behind this study are saying is simply that these ships should be slowing down. If they slow down, they take more care, they look around for whales, then the likelihood of them crashing into them is really reduced. That, of course, would mean some delay to major shipping.
Henry Bellow. A woman has died after taking part in a cake-eating competition in the Australian state of Queensland. She was at an event where contestants were filmed speed-eating lamingtons, sponge cakes covered in chocolate and grated coconut. Richard Hamilton reports.
The 60-year-old woman had a seizure on Sunday at a hotel in Hervey Bay to mark Australia Day. She was taken to hospital but died later. Witnesses said she'd crammed one of the lamington cakes into her mouth when she got into difficulties. Competitive eating, or speed eating, is popular on the country's national day. Contestants win prizes for putting as many cakes, pies, hot dogs and other food into their mouths in a limited time. There are similar events in America, Canada, Japan and here in the UK.
So the timekeepers are going to count down from 3 to 1 and they will shout go, which will be my signal to go. I will pick up the first egg, I will consume it. When I'm happy that my mouth is empty after the first egg, I'll present my mouth open to the timekeeper.
At the World Burger Eating Competition in 2018, Leah Shutkever was ranked as Britain's number one competitive eater. She holds 5 Guinness World Records, including eating a burrito in 35 seconds, a chocolate orange in 65 seconds, and in this challenge, she consumed 3 pickled eggs in 7.8 seconds.
I'm full of eggs, but I'm really happy.
Leah Shutkiver says she's aware of the health challenges but looks after her body well. In the end, she says, it's all about winning trophies.
Any accidents or any incidents associated to sports are tragic, and it is heartbreaking. It really is. I am fortunate to have a very, very loving family and two very supportive parents who do on a daily basis ask me when I'm going to retire, because they do get worried. And I have that risk factor in my mind. I'm not trying to be the world's best, but I can collect a nice little trophy cabinet of world record titles, and that'll do me fine.
There have been several deaths from speed eating in recent years, mostly from choking. Other negative health impacts include perforation of the stomach and ulcers. Critics say it also sends out a message that it's okay to be gluttonous while millions around the world are starving.
That report by Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.